The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters.
It's not a pleasure doing the job that we do, but it's a privilege because people trust us to look after their interests. Very often it involves devastation, so, you know, life-changing, life-limiting injuries, loss of a loved one. And compensation very often is nowhere near the top of the list of priorities. They might want answers as to why that happened. They might want accountability. They might want to ensure the risks are reduced for people in the future.
Hello, listeners. So today I'm talking to Dr. Neil Hudgell. Now, Neil is the executive chairman of Hudgell Solicitors. His legal work includes representing victims of the Post Office Horizon scandal. Now, he's been at the forefront of the fight to secure justice for former sub-postmasters who suffered from what has been called the greatest miscarriage of justice in British history, the UK Post Office scandal. Now, some of our listeners may not be familiar with this scandal, but it essentially involved hundreds of sub-postmasters, and they were prosecuted for theft and false accounting by the Post Office, which is owned by the government. Now, this was based on a faulty accounting software system called Horizon. Many of these sub-postmasters poured some of their own life savings to cover shortfalls in the accounts. What happened is more than 900 Post Office operators were convicted in the courts using IT evidence from the Horizon computer system. That included 700 convictions secured by the Post Office. Now, this was between the years of 1999 and 2015. They were wrongly prosecuted or convicted of theft, false accounting and fraud due to a computer system failure, and that was denied for years. In this episode today, Neil's going to talk about his involvement in representing individuals affected by the Post Office scandal. He's also going to talk about the reason he set up his company, why he wanted to create a business where client care is always the priority. I really enjoyed this interview with Neil. I found him to be really down to earth. He was to the point and he was extremely loyal to his clients. That really shone through for me. I know this is a very much anticipated interview due to the high profile status of this case. I'm sure you're going to enjoy it just as much as I did.
The Hearing.
Neil Hudgell, welcome to The Hearing podcast. It's great to have your company. How are you today?
It's a pleasure to be here. Monday morning, start of a busy week, and what better way to kick it off?
Yeah, well, that's a good start, isn't it? We like you already. Yeah. So, Neil, can you tell us about your journey to becoming the executive chairman of Hudgell Solicitors, first of all? Some people may know you, but just give us a little bit of background in your career.
Wow, that's a big question. It obviously needs a bit of trawling through the memory bank. We celebrated 25 years of Hudgell's two years ago now, so we're into our 27th year. So there's a lot to cover in that almost three decades, I guess. Started out, I was a trainee with the Crown Prosecution Service, and the first day I qualified, I left to private practice, worked for a general practice in Hull. And stayed 3 years, and at the time, 3 years was the sort of time that you had to be employed before you could venture out on your own. So I think I always had that gene around being self-employed, entrepreneurial, call it what you like, commercial. And I've never, through that journey, seen myself as a particularly good technical lawyer. But what I had at day one and what has continued to go through the DNA of the business is really this whole thing around looking after clients, because I qualified and I was pushed out to a branch office in the outskirts of Hull on an estate called North Hull Estate. And anything could come into that office. You know, somebody could have a criminal problem, they could have a family dispute, a personal injury claim, a company formation. And so you can imagine someone that was recently qualified would find all that rather daunting. And what I learned to do was capture the confidence of the client, because there's always somebody who knows the law better than you. And that was a really good grounding for me. And as I say, I sort of was more fascinated in the business side of things and actually the sort of impact of the law. And therefore, the first opportunity I had, I opened Hudgell Solicitors, had two little offices, again, outside of the city centre. I sort of took a decision to do that because if you move to where the people are, the work is naturally there. And touch wood, in that intervening period of time since then, I've never struggled for work. And I think essentially that's because we've always had clients at the centre of everything that we've done. And so that's where that journey started. And really, in that period, there's obviously been a lot that's happened. But we can probably earmark a few particular things. So I think one of those was advertising. It's not that long ago, at the beginning of my legal career, that advertising was a no-no for the legal profession. And that started to become more and more relevant, and we did some TV, did some radio campaigns. Radio campaigns 20-odd years ago were very successful. And that enabled us to sort of grow in terms of critical mass. So we went from sort of a handful of people to 20 to 30 people. And then this wonderful thing called the internet came in, online became a source of business. And we were at the front end of that when it became more engaging with lawyers. And we were starting generating business all over the country. And then we decided to open an office in Leeds because nobody had heard of Hull. So again, that took us on another stage. From there, we sort of saw a bit of a niche in the market where we could bulk up by buying in practices that, for whatever reason, were not going to be carrying on doing the type of work that we're doing. We were essentially a litigation firm doing personal injury, mainstream personal injury and clinical negligence. And so from there, we ended up opening an office in London, at which point then we become a sort of 100-plus firm, so a bigger player, you know, in that mid-market size. And then eventually we opened an office in Manchester and are now approaching about 200 staff. We're in the sort of top 200-300 firms in the country. And now we've sort of morphed into some sort of more high-ticket national inquiry-based work that generates a real sort of national platform in terms of PR, publicity, those sorts of things. So that's a whistle-stop tour of how we got from a sort of virtual one-man band to a fairly sizable business in that sort of, as I say, just under three decades.
Yeah, and you've, I mean, what attracted us to talk to you is your firm has been involved in many very high-profile cases, the Post Office Horizon scandal being one of them, and I've got specific questions for you in relation to that. I think a lot of our listeners will be fascinated by your involvement in that case, but also the Manchester Arena bombing, representing victims from that incident, COVID-19 public inquiry. Could you let us know what particular landmark cases have you been particularly proud of in your time at Hudgell Solicitors? I mean, maybe it's one of those I've mentioned, but does something stand out to you that you think you've been particularly proud of?
I think that's a difficult question on a number of levels, because each person that comes to us has their own very often very tragic set of circumstances to set out. So it's not necessarily the high profile cases that bring the greatest degree of satisfaction. You know, it's not a pleasure doing the job that we do, but it's a privilege because people trust us to look after their interests. And very often it involves devastation. So, you know, life-changing, life-limiting injuries, loss of a loved one. And so it's not necessarily the big ticket stuff that consumes the column inches in the national papers and on TV that are necessarily the landmark cases, but certainly we are recognised for our involvement in a lot of those cases that have led to sort of public inquiries like Manchester, like Post Office, like COVID, Grenfell's another one, infected blood, smart motorways. That's another one. So there's a there's a whole raft of different cases that we would say were deeply privileged to have had people put their trust in us to represent their interests. So it's difficult to pinpoint one that I would say defines us, albeit post office very definitely is front and centre of public opinion and continues to be so, particularly since the dramatisation aired from the New Year's Day this year.
Yeah. And I mean, it must be bittersweet in terms of any compensation or settlements that you achieve for your clients, because as you said, it comes with a raft of emotions and loss and bereavement and all sorts of things that you have to support your client with. How did you prioritise the well-being and interests of your clients, say, from the post office scandal, bearing that in mind? Huge emotional issues going on there for them.
Yeah, I think the first thing to always do, and it's not just post office clients, it's any client, is ask them what they want.
Yeah.
Because you can make assumptions, and those assumptions can be misplaced. So we would always try and understand and get to know the clients. And that's not necessarily the legal case that's from the centre of that. It's understanding what makes them tick. So, for example, some clients in the public inquiry want to be there every day, want to know what's going on, want the minute detail of every witness statement and every witness brief. Others don't want to know. Others want to let you get on with that job and to report back on things that appear to be or seem to be important. Some people want to talk to you about the weather, about football, about what they've had for tea. And that's where you start, is to understand what makes those people tick. And compensation very often is nowhere near the top of the list of priorities. So, you know, you have somebody that's lost a loved one, for example. They might want answers as to why that happened. They might want accountability. They might want to ensure the risks are reduced for people in the future. So compensation might sit at number 4 or 5 on the list. So, you know, that's a real lesson that I've learned through my legal career, is don't make assumptions about people, but try and understand exactly what it is that makes them tick. In terms of, you know, compensation in this process in relation to post office, I think all I'd say about that is what I would say to the clients is, you know, you cannot be compensated for what you've gone through. You cannot repair damaged minds. You cannot get back relationships that are irreparably broken, particularly when people have passed on. So it sits there as something that provides some measure of comfort and hopefully allows them to move on with their lives and not worry about pounds, shillings and pence, particularly in the, you know, the autumn of the lives where people should have retired long before now. So it's quite a difficult place often where to sit compensation. But in terms of mental well-being, I think, again, the media's position in bringing this to the attention of the mainstream UK public is fantastic. You know, it's elevated the whole scandal to a level where there's a scrutiny and accountability that can no longer be swept under the carpet. You know, there will be answers provided. People will probably be prosecuted. But it does have a toll on the individuals. And sometimes it can be too much, you know, reading constantly about what's gone wrong, being under a continuous process of being sort of reaffirmed about how badly wrong they've been done, it can be difficult and can be dangerous. And certainly we've got a lot of medical evidence that says that this process itself is damaging to people. And we make that point continually to government that, you know, we need to get to the end of this process so that people can start to properly heal. Because as it stands, there isn't a working day that most of the post-office victims don't think about the wrong that's been done to them over that last 20 odd years or so. And some of our job is about protecting those people from that continuing public forum that just has it at such a heightened level. And we do that again by knowing the clients, so knowing what when to share stuff, and equally knowing when to shield them. You know, at the end of the day, we are professional advisors. We need to preserve a degree of independence to be able to offer proper advice. But sometimes it's in their best interest not to know the minutiae of what's going on. And so sometimes I don't share the fine detail of negotiation I'm having on particular issues, because what I don't want to do is cause them enhanced anxiety. So really, you know, it's about being aware of the impact of things on them and their mental health.
You've got to have great awareness about your client, as you say, knowing what they want, what the outcome they want, but managing their expectations accordingly as well. Very delicate balance there.
The hearing. On the outside, you're a lawyer, calm and cool, but inside there's a passion to perform, a drive to be absolutely on your game. You prepare hour after hour, day after day, in the pursuit of excellence, relying on superior resources, serious preparation, and total confidence. That's the advantage we give you. Be your best with Thomson Reuters Practical Law.
From the war in Gaza.
There are a huge network of tunnels underneath. It looks like a spider web.
To the front lines in Ukraine.
Extraordinary how these people adjust and even laugh when you take cover.
No matter where the story is, Reuters World News Podcast is there. We bring you everything you need to know in 10 minutes every weekday. I'm your host, Kim Vanell. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
What challenges did you encounter, would you say, Neil, while representing those clients in the post office scandal? Did you encounter any major challenges during the course of the litigation process?
The ongoing challenges remain essentially around, well, communication is a challenge because we represent now about 500 clients across the different schemes. There are a number of schemes, there's three or four schemes. And one thing that we need to make sure that we do is deliver important news to everyone in a timely manner. I don't think there's anything worse than one client hearing something from another client rather than hearing it from us first. So there's a real logistical challenge to make sure that anything that is important is shared consistently across everyone. The obvious challenge with government is to get them to act quickly enough. I think there are issues that they have to tackle internally within the corridors of Whitehall and the Treasury and what have you. And so nothing ever really happens quickly enough, as you know, in law. You know, law tends to be convoluted, overcomplicated. So you can imagine in something like this as well, that where you're dealing with so many victims, and that has its challenges. And really, that's the biggest thing, because what we have is an increasingly aging cohort of heavily damaged people that for some continue to work into what ought to be their retirement years, that need closure and that, you know, should be putting the feet up and relaxing in that time. And so, you know, we're trying to deliver outcomes in the face of a system that makes that slow and bureaucratic.
Yeah. And the litigation process is painfully slow, isn't it, in terms of achieving justice for people as well. It's managing your clients in that respect. Are you able to discuss any notable outcomes or settlements achieved for the clients at this stage?
I'd rather not. I think that as you might know, there are some public statistics that government publish on overall settlement numbers. But my brief really is to respect the confidentiality of people individually. Generally, they're pretty private people. What I would say is that, you know, again, no compensation is ever enough for what they've been through. But I would like to probably just sort of address this, maybe this perception that they're all going to become instant millionaires overnight. You know, these were people that mostly ran a community-driven facilities, you know, a post office in the heart of a rural community or in the heart of an estate. You know, they were never get-rich-quick schemes. You know, these were people that made an honest living. And so, you know, the money that they'll get will hopefully help settle any residual liabilities that many of them still have and give them some comfort into their later years, but certainly don't set them up as, you know, multimillionaires overnight.
Yeah, sure. And what lessons have you learned from doing these cases? And have those lessons influenced your approach to similar cases in the future, would you say?
I think in terms of lessons learned is to assume nothing. And I think that what we have probably seen increasingly since the dramatisation that aired again is the horrific revelations that have continued to roll out about the conduct of post office, Fujitsu, and senior people involved in those organisations in terms of the, you know, blatant cover-up of the whole extent of this scandal. You know, we knew it was bad and had insight into some of the things that had gone on. But the extent of that has prevailed over such a long period of time does lead you to think, actually, you know, this is the post office, which is obviously one of the biggest institutions in the UK and has been for a long time. If they're capable of some of these behaviours, then who else is? You know, it's sort of like assume nothing is the bottom line for me.
And a question I hear quite often in interviews about this case is, why did it take so long? Why did it take the serialisation of a drama to really capture the public's imagination? Because there were various attempts to bring this to the public's imagination and get the attention of government and the media, but it fell on deaf ears, really. What is your view about that? Why did it take so long? And why did it take a drama to really thrust this into the public's imagination?
Well, I think initially it was obviously an inequality of arms. You know, there was a cover-up and people were not sufficiently powerful enough to mount a strategic defence and counter-attack. So that was the sort of explanation for the early years. And then obviously, as things started to unravel, there was this obvious disbelief that could an organisation behave in that manner. So what actually happened was that there were people being carried on and believing the narrative that eventually proved to be the truth. But that was everybody that got onboarded had to be convinced. You know, even when I started looking at this, it was like, well, I'm not sure I can really believe that that's right. You know, could it be that bad? You know, you've got people being accused of being the only ones with IT problems, literally in their hundreds. And people, investigators, auditors, etc., were going into post offices one in the morning and saying this, and then doing the same in the afternoon. You know, that pattern of human behaviour is, you know, is callous and cruel. And, you know, it's very hard to believe that an organisation should be so culturally ingrained that once they're put in an IT system, they are in effect trying to fulfil their own narrative that they were catching out a nation of dishonest shopkeepers. So right up till the dramatisation, people were believing the story, but they needed educating as to it, which took some doing. What the dramatisation did, it was elevate onto the national platform in 4 hours, 20 years worth of what had gone on. And it was a brilliant piece of drama because they got it. People got it. It was distilled down into a way that anyone could say, wow, it is that bad. And actually, it was worse. You know, the stuff that was not on the drama that would elevate to yet another level. So I think that the dramatisation, as I say, captured in 4 hours 20 years worth of work. And then the other thing that it did as well is it elevated the postmasters on an emotional level and gave them the confidence to know, actually, yeah, I didn't do this. And actually, people now do believe me, because even up to that point, they felt that they were telling their story to people. But the people were like, well, there's no smoke without fire. You know, there still was this sort of, you could see it in their eyes that there's still this residual doubt whether they were telling the truth or not. But the drama blew all that away. And now we've got people that have got the confidence to take on that challenge. And there's this, just this impetus and momentum that, as I say, is in a different place to where it's been before. And so the hope is that 2024 is finally that breakthrough year where there is accountability and, importantly, there is closure for as many people as possible.
Yeah, and I think the cover-up relied on almost gaslighting people, thinking that they were the one at fault. It was an IT glitch or something, and it wasn't happening to many other hundreds of people as well. So that enabled this to cover up to happen. How did you feel watching that drama? That must have evoked a lot of emotions. I mean, what was going through your mind? Was it a sense of at last the story's being told in an accurate way, or what was happening for you?
Well, it's interesting because I actually was privileged to get an invite to the sort of preview before Christmas. I went with Joe Hamilton, who's a client of mine, who's obviously one of the central characters in the story. And so I knew the sort of story and the plot, but what I didn't know, obviously, was how it was going to be presented. And it sort of just brought to life the characters of Joe, of Noel Thomas, who was another client of mine, Michael Rudkin, and others as well, in a way that the general public could see that he's just not normal, ordinary folk like you and I, going about the daily business, and chopped off at the knees. You know, the opening scenes of the first episode show the Black Mariah's pulling up, and that's like this sort of sinister mob from post office. Well, Black Mariah's didn't pull up, but, you know, the whole sort of way that it was portrayed in the psyche was that they may as well have done, because that's how these poor people were treated. You know, they'd call the helpline for help. And what they got instead was auditors coming in, calling them from a pig to a dog, and being thrown out of the post office there. And then a sign stuck on the door saying, basically, post office closed, there's a thief working within.
Wow. Yeah. Gosh. And, you know, just to wrap up, I mean, I could talk to you all day about this. I've got lots of questions. I know time is limited. In terms of the legal industry, what do you think, putting you on the spot a bit here, what do you see as the biggest challenge facing the legal industry in the coming years? And how do you think your firm is preparing for those challenges? That's a big question, isn't it?
I think that it's a big question, but then I always pair it back to its basics in many senses. I think what we've got is, obviously, we've got an evolving platform with AI, artificial intelligence in particular, that will revolutionise some processes within the industry, but will not be a one-size-fits-all. I think in the type of work that we do, human interaction remains front and centre. You know, you cannot replace personal interaction with a client, and I think you again have to have compassion, an understanding of the brief that's in front of you. And, you know, I look at some of the legal advisors that have been involved down the years in the post office litigation that are going to have the torch of scrutiny shone on them within the inquiry over the next 2 to 3 months. And, you know, we've got to be really careful that while we represent clients, that we don't lose a sense of right and wrong and of fairness and, you know, doing the right thing. And, you know, I spoke to some university students a couple of weeks ago, and they're obviously at the start of a career. And I was explaining to them that, you know, they're the energy of the next generation and will bring some shape and focus on the industry in terms of some technological developments. But ultimately, the tools that they need are the same tools that I had when I started, and that was a work ethic, an interest in what we're doing, and integrity, but equally as well, compassion and understanding. I think those are personal qualities that, regardless of the landscape within the profession, have to continue to prevail at all times.
Yeah, and certainly the cases you've been involved with, I mean, with any client, you show that compassion and empathy and understanding. But really, you know, in terms of their losses and bereavements, they need hand-holding, really, and that empathy. You can't replace that with AI, really keeping them at the centre of that human element. Thank you, Neil. That's been wonderful. I could talk to you all day. Fascinating man. We'll probably have to get you back at some point to talk about your other cases as well. But thank you so much for being a great guest on the Hearing Podcast. Thank you for your time.
It's a privilege to speak to you. Thank you.
The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters. To find out more, go to tr.com/thehearing. Or subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.